So today we really will finish the 10 unwholesome pathways. What's the difference between an unwholesome pathway of karma and just karma, just an act of karma? What's the difference?
Suffering.
Yeah. It leads to the rebirth. So then just, like, don't forget, it's got to have these qualifying factors to make it complete. And if it isn't complete, it's uncertain how it will ripen. And even if it is complete, it's not certain that it will ripen. Right? A lot of permutation combination possibilities. And here I have another quote from Geshe Sopa, my dear old granddad. If you want to behave with pure, wholesome action or conduct, you first have to understand what that means. You have to know what's right and what's wrong. Then you need the motivation to avoid the negative actions you tend to do. When certain temptations appear, you must immediately try to restrain your tendency to pursue those objects. Such restraint itself is a wholesome, virtuous, karmic action because it stops actions that harm others. Proper conduct is to eliminate harmful actions and their suffering results. The most effective method to do this is by taking a vow with a clear understanding that the vow means you will purposely avoid doing improper actions. When you see that certain actions are wrong and you think, I should not be behaving in that way, and through wisdom, you decide to avoid those harmful actions, that itself becomes virtuous activity, virtuous karma, wholesome karma. On the other hand, if you just happen not to commit a negative action without any intention to avoid it, that action will be neither virtue nor non-virtue, but will instead be a neutral action. Okay, now we've gone through actions of the body, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and we've gone through the actions of speech, of which there's a great, like, activity in speaking, because that's the whole human situation. So there was lying and slander, harsh speech. There's lying, harsh speech. Well, how am I going to get these in order here? Lying, slander, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. Now you all are really afraid of prattle, right? Empty, meaningless, forgetful things to say. It is really why people don't suffer fools easily, because of all their nonsense talking. I have one Burmese monk. Oh my God, he was so strict. He used to spend, when he was a young monk, he used to spend his nights meditating in the cemetery. All the Burmese people are so afraid of cemeteries. But you find the big hero monks there meditating all night. So anyway, he said to me one time, he said, you got it, the young girl in robes, so they really want to, like, encourage. Like, you're young, you could spend your whole life, you know, pursuing Dharma. So he gave me this nice piece of advice. He said, you do your best to keep those robes. The main benefit is that when people see you, they will not waste your time talking rubbish.
Has that been true?
Oh, yeah, you bet. People think twice what they... I mean, I can tell that they do. And not only that, but if somebody has, like, some strong connection in Dharma in the past, and they see me, like, even on the bus, sometimes people just run up and say, I knew the 16th Karmapa. And then suddenly I'm the person to receive, you know, their great intense feelings of how important that was.
If I could just say a thing about the power of the robes, which is, I just find it really beautiful. So we live on Capitol Hill, right in the middle of Seattle. It's one of the places on the West Coast, teeming with young people, teeming with people. And, you know, Venerable Thomadina is, you know, she's an icon in the neighborhood. She goes to the grocery, and it's a Dharma activity. You know, they're not students in the Dharma Center, but, you know, the person in the counter, behind the counter wants to say, oh, you know, I have this friend who's trying to draw from heroin. Do you have a suggestion for something he could read? I mean, the Burmese guy that the fish seller in the grocery
sushi.
He's, you know, offering and all of the everybody loves to see her. And when you go out into the neighborhood and walk with the venerable through the neighborhood, in the crosswalks and intersections, people stop way back. As opposed to when I'm all by myself. If I'm lucky, they stop within a foot or two, and I have not count on that. But with the robes, no matter who it is, everybody feels good and uplifted to see somebody who has clearly dedicated their lives to important values, even if they're not quite sure what they are. Whoever it is, they're on their cell phone, you know, they're stopping way back there. It's very beautiful.
Anyway, Tenzin Jesse prefers to be plain clothes, undercover Dharma agent. So that's her deal.
It's a great act of generosity, you know. You need a quart of milk, you go down to the grocery and, you know, you're on duty as a Dharma teacher. That's really a great gift.
Okay, so here we go. Now, among the mental actions, there are two categories. The first two, covetousness and malice, come under domains. Right. So now, previously, even though we've been talking about body and speech, that's all of the domain of, now suddenly I want to make sure I have this right. We fall into three domains. The actions that transgress and affect others, right? Those are all of the body and the speech ones. Now, when we're moving into the ones to talk about covetousness and malice, this is the domain of mental purification. And when you purify covetousness and malice, which means that you abandon it, you decide this is no good, I don't want to promote that, and what do you take up? The opposite of those, which would be, for example, in this Indian way of expressing, it would be non-greed, which has many kind of manifestations, not the least of which is a wholesome sense of renunciation. That means abandoning what is obscuring you in that way of acquisitiveness. Renunciation. I mean, just let me use the word renunciation. Even it may make you feel uncomfortable, but just let me use it. And then when we let go of malice, then we turn to that is purified by way that we abandon thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming, thoughts of cruelty. So those of you who have some kind of familiarity with the Eightfold Noble Path, think, what are the first couple of path factors, right? Well, I've talked a lot. One is right view. And then that's the cognitive aspect of practice that's going to lead organize your value system set you up for your sense of what you're looking for, what's the reality of how things are existing. So if there's cognitive, or if there's wisdom, what's going to be the other wing? Compassion. Yes, compassion. So when we purify malice, that then amounts to the compassion side. So you've got the view, right view, and then right aspiration is emotional resonance, your, like, the emotional sense of conviction that is needful to support your cognitive understanding and to keep you involved with a long-term goal, right? So what is right aspiration? Renunciation. Thoughts of metta, of non-harming and non-cruelty, right there. So this is how, this is just in the structure of how these 10 unwholesome factors are operating in other aspects of how Dharma thought is structured. I just want to point that out to you, that we're about to enter into the area which has to do with the first, the leading team of factors for developing your spiritual practice that will take you into understanding dukkha. It will take you into understanding cause, how to totally pacify those potential dukkha arisings, and what's the way to develop your life, right? And then even if you look at the Eightfold Noble Path, so there's the first two factors, right view and right aspiration. And then what? Right away, what are you on to? Ethical discipline, your livelihood, and what's called right action, which means what? It means all of these things that we've just been talking about. Okay, now I'm going to go. Covetousness, any object that belongs to somebody else. Now, first we had stealing, but this is a little different. This is a mental activity. So it could be a material possession that belongs to them, or it could be something immaterial, such as fame or their reputation or their intellectual property rights. Okay. You have it clear in your mind that this is something you wish to possess. You have a clear desire to own that object yourself. So there's a motivation here. The motivation could be, and is prevailingly, greed. You want that thing. Now, you may want that thing and wish for that by way of, like, wanting to hurt someone by having their possessions, or wanting to humiliate them by having their possessions. But in the final analysis, like, there can be other things that are operating, but the thing is, it's a greed activity. Or it could be motivated by delusion, which is a faulty view. And that could be like a sense of like royal privilege, that you have the feeling that you are the powerful person, and what the other people have, you admire, and you can take it for yourself. There's no law against it if it really is royal privilege. There's an ancient situation. And yes, and even today, where there's royalty, I mean, not much is spoken of about this. I mean, this is like not the greatest thing that's wrong with the world, but this is still something that goes on, that the powerful person sees it and they think, my power gives me the right to change the ownership, you know, from yours to mine. But right now, we're not talking about stealing. We're talking about that mental activity of setting your mind on it, that what belongs to the other person, you want it to belong to you. So the act, because it's a mental thing, there's no physical and no verbal as yet. So the act is generating a state of mind that wishes to possess the belongings of the others, and it's stronger than ordinary greed. And the completion is you have a decision. So this is the thing with mental karma. Mental karma is you agree finally with that thought, and you settle with it. You have a conclusion that you rest with. Yes, this is the right action plan. So there's a resolve. And is resolve the same thing as intention? It is. Resolve and intention are not different. And so is intention karma? It is, right? So that's a karmic action. There's no physical action necessary. Now, here, Geshe Sirpa, he has to say this. So, okay, like, I'm just reminding you. This, so right, I'm unfolding the fullness of the possibility of this action. As, and if it's a fully qualified one, then it has the potential to direct the rebirth. So as you all are listening, you will feel, oh, I'm not like that. But the thing is, you've like listen, because you, if you're missing one or two of the pieces, it means that you just, it won't direct rebirth. But it doesn't mean that it's not an unwholesome karma, because now we're going to discuss greed. Here we go. All right, so there's for the qualities to make a complete karma of covetousness, they are as follows. You must have a very strong attachment to your own possessions. Do you ever feel that way, that you have a strong attachment to your own possessions? Yes, we do. You must have an avaricious craving to accumulate wealth, never being satisfied with what you already have. Do you have even a little bit of that? Is it like that sometimes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's up to you how you're relating to this.
I think never being satisfied.
Right. Never being satisfied. Anyway, he's going to go on. Anyway, I do think that it is pretty extraordinary if people are really satisfied. Oh, and I just can't resist sometimes these little stories. My mother moved about 10 years ago from the place where I grew up. She moved back to, down to the south where she's from. And she, like, shopped around and decided, I want to live in this gated community. Okay, then there's a fellow who's the salesman there. And so we're having these conversations because she wants to join there. And he's like, well, we have this plot for you and you could have this design of house and on like this. So my mother is there. She was in her late 70s then, and then her best friend also, these old ladies. Now, don't you think that they look like Princess Diana, right? This is not, they're old ladies. Stout, both of them. And so here we go. This guy's young. He's got a young family and a young wife. So here you go. And he's, anyway, so it's a funny thing that's happening. As the conversations unfold, it comes out that the old ladies are very keenly interested to have very large closets in their houses. Why? Because both of them, like my mother is the thing with the shoes. It's got lots of shoes. Like she and Imelda Marcos would really be able to sit down and have a good old chin wag about those shoes, right? And on the other hand, my mother's best friend, clothing, right? Like, again, I got to tell you this, you're not talking about Princess Diana here, who would, like, be great to look at all the time. So the guy is really consternated, like, oh, is this what I have to look forward to, what women become? You marry them and they're slender and fertile, they give you children, and you have to make a lot of compromises, but then do they become that? Anyway, so it was kind of shocking for him to think of what size closets are needed to take care of all of these, like, unending accumulations. And isn't there a time in life when a person decides it's enough, right? Anyway.
That's why I love the Goodwill.
Yes, yes. I'll see you there. That's right. We're all big fans of Goodwill here in Capitol Hill in Seattle. Okay, so there you go. Never being satisfied with what you already have. Okay, number three. You must have a mind that sees others' possessions as very fine and longs to enjoy those things. Ooh. You are so attached to your own things and you want to accumulate more and more. Then you see what others have and you develop a strong need to experience the pleasure of those things. Yeah, some people have long sighs. Mm-hmm. Okay, number four. You must have a greedy mind, thinking that whatever pleasurable objects others have, you need to have yourself. Maybe that was already number four, you have a greedy mind. Anyway, now this really is number five. As a result of covetousness, your mind is overcome by shamelessness. Now this is the part that makes it a heavy and complete karma. I mean, all of them have a participation, but this one is very kind of grave. As a result of covetousness, your mind is overcome by shamelessness, and you are oblivious to the need of escaping from this fault. Ooh, that's so grim. The covetous mind has no thought of shame. Now, that's the problem with all unwholesome karmas, is that the sense of cherishing one's personal decency is disabled under the influence of unskillful, unwholesome, like, motivations. Okay, so the covetous mind has no thought of shame. It does not recognize that this avaricious attitude is wrong. So it has no thought of turning away from it. So if you have all of these qualities of mind, if all of these qualities are present, that covetous mind is, so to speak, perfect. It is a fully developed and complete covetousness. If any of it is lacking, it's not a complete karma, but it is unskillful. So a couple days ago, I was saying it's better to... there's more possibility and potential in if you know that you're doing something wrong. And there's less possibility for transformation if you don't know that you're doing something wrong. So here again, you find this. And just to follow that up with a practical note, again, it's like you find yourself doing something wrong, then you can also hold that with a kind of compassion and not have any kind of denial about it. Here I am. I'm so out of control. Here I am doing this thing that I think is wrong. Oh, especially with your shopping stuff, right? That you find yourself, like, you have a budget and you've decided, now no more new shoes, right? And then because you have such a habit of shopping for those things, and then you find yourself, something comes, they send you a coupon, or there's a big sale, and like from the back of your mind you feel pushed. You can't resist it. And the whole time you're feeling very ambivalent and anguished. That's beautiful, actually. You feel ambivalent and anguished. You feel so turbulent, and you feel oppressed. I can't stand. I can't sleep at night. That sale is going on. And then you click on it and you have this feeling, this is so stupid what I'm doing. This is so stupid. I said I wasn't going to do it. And you have such doubt. Do I really need this thing? Right? And then you may get it and you just, like, you know, there's now they have practically instant delivery, right? But if it takes some days, you may then, you know, have put it aside and forgotten how life or death it was that thing was coming. Anyway, and then you get it and you feel like, now where am I going to put it? Anyway, so, but that's actually very, like, a sign of you're nearly going to be cured of excessive shopping. If it gets to that you feel such a kind of buyer's remorse. That's really very beautiful. So anyway, you can... When you find yourself, you know, being in upheaval, don't be in a quick hurry to become peaceful. Oh, take good advantage of that upheaval to gain out of that as much wisdom and compassion as you can get. That is great. You got to keep that mindfulness shining right into those things.
And then I don't even let myself look. I just don't even click on it.
Yeah, that's so great. Yeah, that's a practice of sense restraint.
Yeah. I just yeah. Get it. I'll want it if I look.
Yeah, that's right. And that's very reasonable, look at, into cause and effect, because if that kind of thing gets into your awareness, it's very hard not to be influenced and drawn into a certain direction and then brought into a lot of pulling and pushing and all like that. So it's just easier to decide when you don't need something to decide, I don't need this. I don't need anything, so this is not the time for shopping. Then, when you do need something, you know, I do need something, and I can undertake my shopping with a sense of perspective rather than just being, you know, drawn around. Okay. So, going once, going twice on covetousness. Now we've finished that. Malice. Scary, isn't it? Malice. Nobody wants to be with malicious people. Here we go. So there's an object, a living being who would be hurt if our harmful thoughts were carried out. And we may wish that the person experienced financial ruin or that they're destroyed by somebody else. We may wish that they come to harm, to danger, their reputation is destroyed. The whole gamut of wishing ill will. So the intention. And they're not just a person. It can be any kind of sentient being, all the way down to your mosquitoes. I'll give you one example. So intention is a state of mind whereby you desire to harm. You desire to make others suffer. That's the intention. The motivation, anger, that's the usual thing. And the act of malice is the arising of the malicious wish that harm should come to another person. That's the act. It's the mental process of indulging in this kind of thought as it develops, increases, and becomes stronger. That's the act. The completion of the act is when your wish to harm increases to the extent that you make a definite decision to harm someone. So that's it. We're back to the decision. Now, well, I give some examples. Politicians are very often, you know, like otherwise people are very mild-mannered, you know, careful to sweep the ants away nicely. But when it comes to politicians, they hate them, right? And anyway, like that, hating politicians. Yeah, I always think about how I was really afraid that my mother would die of a stroke when George Bush was president because she hated him so much and all ranting and raving about the terrible things. So anyway, and then do you think that now she's happy? No. I'm so sorry. But that bent of mind will always find some pasture to graze in, to nourish itself, and that mind will arise again with some perception of being afflicted by somebody who's powerful and out of control and who doesn't agree with her values. And has she changed the course of history with her frustrations? No, she has not changed the course of history. I don't know, maybe then you all will say, but she probably did vote. Yeah, she voted. But it was not just her. And it wasn't her malice that changed the course of history. It was her voting, right? Okay. And then how about mosquitoes, right? Wow. Like, I mean, just to take the whole spectrum, we have a feeling, you know, some itch is there. And then we turn and we think, oh, we're in a malaria area. That mosquito. And there's a sense of very intense, like wanting to kill that mosquito because it presents a danger to us. So that it's that mental intention to cause harm. Anyway, in that you'll find anyway that you have a lot of experience of malice, and you know you with these little things that go on. That you feel like the slugs that eat the vegetables in your garden. You have malice toward them. Anyway, people want to cause them harm. Anyway, you think about it.
I want to ask about, so let's say you have all of those feelings about a person,
mm-hmm.
and you do not act.
Yeah, good. At least there's that.
But then someone else harms them. And then,
and if you rejoice, you accrue the complete karma of killing, because you're like approving of that.
Even if he does something bad, it causes
right. So this is good. Thank you, Mary Ellen. Just to like touch on this again, you're gonna a person will accrue a complete karma if one self carries it out. Second way of accruing the full karma, if we make somebody else engage in that activity, we make them do it, right? Third, if we approve of it, like that's so good that X, Y, Z, like fill in the blank.
But if you don't approve of it, but...
I haven't finished.
Okay.
It's my turn.
I'm sorry, I thought you were done.
Yeah, I can understand that. So number four way of accruing the complete karma, if we speak in praise of it, right? Now you can say?
If you don't say a word,
yeah,
because you just don't think that would be appropriate,
mm-hmm.
but you smile to yourself and say, well, he got his just rewards.
Is that approving of it?
It's not approving of the action of the malice that went into creating the downfall.
Uh-huh.
But it is saying to oneself.
So you think that they should have been, you know, like caused to be ruined in a nicer way?
No. I think that they deserve what they got.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, yeah, okay, I see your point.
Yeah, I mean... You just don't go around saying, ha-ha, they got it. But you might think, it's about time.
Still, that thing of it's about time is kind of, sounds like malice. It's about time that you feel satisfied that they got punished. Whereas, if you see that there's a situation that's been building up, and the person has been provoking, and then they come to ruin, something terrible happens. You can have, your point of view can be, with more equanimity, how could it be otherwise?
Okay. Just don't smile.
You can also have a lot of compassion.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least equanimity. Like, how could it be otherwise? They've been putting in place the causes for this to happen. And this practice of equanimity is important in order to keep relating to people, because you guaranteed everybody's got somebody difficult in their life who's very resistant to doing things which would be for their own benefit. Don't you think?
Very ignorant.
That's right. So they're resistant. Not easy for them to make changes on like this, and you suffer out of you have a aversion and compassion all mixed together. That it'd be more peaceful and nice for you if they would make some changes. It'd be more peaceful and nice for them if they would make more changes on like this. So what are you going to take hold of in order to be able to bear that unbearable situation? As you look at the reality of it, they're actively putting in place causes that are irresistibly arising in this way. And I don't have any control. You have to have something to reflect on to give yourself strength to bear and to take your blood pressure down and to relax and to get some kind of independence of mind and equilibrium and to get your feet planted in something other than the distress of wishing things were different. Okay, I have a list I'm going to go through talking about malice. So this is for the fully qualified, heaviest example of this karmic action. One, you must have a mind of hatred that grasps firmly at a cause or reason why you want to do harm to another person. For example, If you feel that someone damaged you in the past, you may harbor an intense resentment toward that person and hold very firmly to what that person did as a reason why you should give harm in return. Now, number two, you must have a mind that cannot bear the harm that was done to you. This is a kind of interesting comment. Like, you have no patience. You have nothing, like what I was talking about, you have to have something to reflect on that will make your mind strong. So then this is saying you must have a mind that doesn't have any inner resources and that you feel completely under the power of the hatred of that harm that was done to you. That was number two. Number three, you must have a mind of resentment, which comes from recollecting and repeatedly dwelling on the reasons for your anger. Over and over you tell yourself, this person did this terrible thing to me. You meditate on the harms that you believe your enemy has done to you until this powerful thought of resentment arises. Number four, you must have a mind of vengeance with a thought such as, it would be good if that person were beaten or killed. And then after you've meditated on the harm that you believe someone has done to you, you finally feel the need to hit back, to repay the harm in some fashion. So there's like a decision there. Last, final, number five. Finally, you must have a mind that is overcome with malice, oblivious to the disadvantages of such an attitude, without shame, which is to say, without a sense of your personal decency, and uninterested in avoiding such faults. When you have no countervailing thought challenging your vengeful desire to harm your enemy, when you feel no regret, no shame, no hesitation or doubt, when you are completely under the power of that thought, that's the fifth and final element for complete and perfect malice. And there you pop that mosquito. And you feel satisfied. Yeah? So what do you think? So does malice exist in the world? Do people suffer malice? Okay, just checking here. Yeah. Anyway, here's Geshe Sopo, a little comment that he makes. You can use these examples to examine the situation you find yourself in. And based on that understanding, you'll be able to turn away from such harm. As soon as a small malicious thought arises, even though you could not prevent it from arising, it's karmic ripening, right? In the back of your mind, you will still have a feeling of shame. It's so beautiful, that feeling of being ashamed of things that are unworthy to engage in. Anyway, you have a feeling of shame, a regretful feeling that counteracts that negative intention. In one corner of your mind, wisdom says this is wrong. With this small antidote, even though a malicious thought arises, it will not become a complete karma. Yeah? So do I have to say something about shame? Like, why do I think shame is so great? Why does Geshe Sofa think shame is going to save the day here? So what is this feeling of shame? There's, this is a Tenzin Jesse clearing her throat. She feels so restless if I land on this word and really spread out with it. And she can't do anything to stop me right now. So what does this mean? It gets variously translated. In Pali, it's hiri. And then the pair that goes with it is otapa. So sometimes they translate hiri as a moral shame. But what it really means is you feel mostly, like in your normal state, you feel connected with your basic goodness. And there is it's not like the highest thing in the world, but there's a sense of pride with that is useful. And that sense of cherishing your own goodness is a protective measure. It's a protective mental factor. And in Buddhism, they call that moral shame. Yeah. And then you feel afraid to defile, to besmirch, to damage that goodness that you feel. So there's moral fear and moral dread. You're afraid of how you would feel about yourself if you did such a thing. You would feel afraid to cause yourself harm. You would feel afraid. What would the people that you admire, what would they think of you if they knew that you were about to do this? Or what would they think of you if you did that thing? So this also is protective. Or you think, so many people, so one thing is thinking the people you admire. Then there are also all the people who admire you and have an expectation of you to be a good person and to set an example. That also is protective. So this is beautiful thing about, human beings, higher primates, social peer pressure. We care what people think of us and we care what we think of ourselves. So that's a protective measure to also reinforce, to give strength and all good things to that sense of resolve. Unskillful things, I know what they are. I see that this is what it is arising in my mind. I feel that this is not according to my value system. And I can step back and just allow this. I can allow myself not to engage in it. So that's different than feeling personally ashamed. I'm a bad person. It's a little different than that. Or the guilt or all like that. Anyway, all of Buddhism is full of, let's shine the light on the dark side. Let's really illuminate and expose the shadow side of the psyche. Let's mindfulness will fall equally onto the beautiful things and the unbeautiful things. Same like the sun in the sky. It shines on whatever is, the landfills, such a nice euphemism for a big garbage dump. It will shine equally without any hesitation on all of the filth of the garbage dump. And equally, mindfulness will shine on the sublime, wholesome, beautiful mental qualities, right? So this is why then in Buddhism they can promote these strong things like shame and, fear and dread and all those things, because it's not in essence a psychology or a path of practice of suppression by way of repression. Anyway, my whole full discussion about that. Any comments? Going once, going twice? Okay.
Just that these words, these translations, that
yeah.
It's cultural freight, right?
Yeah.
That makes it difficult.
Yeah, that's right.
That's all that is.
Yeah.
So I travel a lot in Asia and Japan, and it said Japan is a shame-based culture.
Yeah, oh,
you bet.
And
the West is a guilt-based culture.
Uh-huh, sure.
Make that kind of distinction. And there's no problem. I mean, that's right. Understood to be valuable in Japanese culture.
Right.
But you have a sense of, not
doing honor,
honor
and shame.
So it's just that the way the words have phrases.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, now those two, that's the domain of mental purification. And in terms of mental purification, when you purify acquisitiveness and covetousness and you purify malice, what you get are the emotional factors that are going to support your right view for your spiritual practice. You're going to see, let me keep my life simple and not get crazed with wanting more and more. Let me have a sense of, according to my situation, renunciation. Let me cultivate all my relationships and my thoughts about beings with metta. Let me wish beings well. And let me wish whatever harm comes to me, let me not return harm with thoughts of malice. Let me unbind and release that fraught relationship. Somebody wishes harm to me or obstructing me. Let me at least avoid and not give rise to thoughts of cruelty or harming. Yeah, so that's the, and that is, if you think of somebody, a saintly person, those are the first things that you would think about. You would think, I should feel safe with a person who's saintly, that they'll have compassion, they won't judge me, that whatever I've done, they won't resent me or something like this. You would just think of this as there's an emotional, when you think of somebody as being saintly, immediately you think of the emotional side. Okay, and then in Buddhism we're talking about liberation, and so maybe then you think of the cognitive side about the defilements being uprooted or something like that. But anyway, it comes back to this. This is an important aspect of your Eightfold Path. And now we come to discussing the domain of wisdom. Wrong view, which when it's purified becomes right view. And in this case, still, it's a mundane right view. All right, here we go. Wrong view. So in this worldview, the law of karma is an aspect of a generalized principle of the law of nature. The law of nature is observed to go all according to cause and effect, cause and result. So that's considered to be real. Wrong view is something which is going to deny the reality of that. So here we go. The object, it must be something which actually exists. So here, here, what's meant in this nihilistic view is that the nihilistic view is one to say there's no reality in such a thing. Nihilism means like you fill in the blank. Such a thing, such an aspect of reality does not exist. Nihilism. What else? How else can I work out something to say about nihilism? I just keep coming back to this comment. Things which do exist, a nihilist or one of a nihilistic view will say, that thing does not exist. Anyway, let it be. So what are the realities that a nihilist denies? The law of karma. Cause and effect gets denied. Liberation gets denied by a nihilist. Samsara gets denied by a nihilist. The Four Noble Truths, the noble truth of dukkha, the noble truth of the arising of dukkha, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, and the noble truth of the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha, all get denied by the nihilist. So that is the wrong view, is to deny these things. Wrong views occur when you do not understand a particular subject and yet nevertheless maintain incorrect notions about it with a conviction. Okay, so there you go. There's a conviction, and it's based on not understanding. There are incorrect notions, and we feel very resolute about those incorrect notions. An example is when you don't properly understand karma, but nevertheless maintain firmly that they are not true. All right, right away I want to make a little, before I go on. To maintain firmly that they're not true. There is no such thing as karma. There's no such thing as unwholesome actions. There's no such thing as the karmic fruit of unwholesome actions. There's no such thing as rebirth. There's no such thing as past and future lives. No such thing, right? Okay. Is that different than saying, I don't believe in those things? Is that equivalent? All right, to say that you don't believe just means that you don't believe in those things. It's not saying that those things don't exist. That's saying that you don't believe. Same like this, you know, you may say, I'm not sure. Or you may say, I don't like to believe in those things. Fair enough, right? But that's to say that you don't like to believe in those things is not the same as saying they are not true or real. Is that clear? Yeah. So here we go. Well, that's the object, and now here's the intention. The intention is thinking it's correct to deny these things. The direct motivation is wanting to deny the existence of these things. The state of mind in which you fully intend to contradict these teachings of the Buddha. So it's what is the motivating emotion is delusion. And then what's the act of this wrong view, this mental wrong view, right? The act is to engage in that kind of wrong view. That means that you ponder it, you take it up, you become resolved on it. This involves a process of contemplating and progressively cultivating that kind of thought until you actually hold that wrong view. So, and like I said, there it gets divided slightly into its different aspects. Denial of the cause, and that means that one wants to deny that there are wholesome actions. One wants to deny that there is, that there are things which are ethical or morally correct. One wants to deny that things are skillful. So that's a denial of the cause. Then denying the result, one wants to deny that those things lead to something or are creative of things or productive of result. And then if we say that one wants to deny an existent object, that would mean one wants to deny that people practice correctly according to Dharma. One wants to deny that those people get insight and realization and liberation. One wants to deny no such thing. All, you know, rubbish. Okay, so the wrong view denies that cause. I have just said that I explained that. Result, I've explained. So if you're agnostic, there's no fault. If you say, I just don't know, I'm thinking about it, I know that's what they say, not sure, there's no fault. Now, and you could be motivated to hold a wrong view because that's what your boyfriend thinks, or it's fashionable to think like that, or you want to get in with the people who have that view, or you feel like it makes you look very bold to have that view, or on the other hand, you may feel that you like to be conservative and it's not what you grew up with, so you don't like that view, so you want to deny. So lots of motivations could be. So the completion now is making the definite decision to deny those teachings by saying they're not true. Here again, five aspects constitute a complete, perfect, fully developed wrong view. One, You must have an ignorant mind that does not understand the way things actually are. Well, that's hardly a beginning point. Like, that's why we're all here. Number two. Oh, no, here, I've got a further comment. You're confused and mistaken about the way in which objects exist. You're confused about reality or the way things are in nature. You're confused. Number two. You must have a mind that enjoys non-virtue, that delights in performing harmful actions. Do you think this exists in the world? It does. You must have a mind that continuously engages in wrong thinking as a result of concentrating on incorrect teachings. Such wrong thinking describes a faulty reasoning process that leads to accepting a wrong view. Now here, like if you think back to the story of Angulimala, the fellow who had the teacher who said, you know, your next, you know, task as a student is to go and kill all these people. You will appreciate. There are very serious wrong views, although that's different then. But in a way it is. It's like denying that there's gonna, that those are unskillful things to do, and asserting that the result of him collecting, killing all those people and collecting all those fingers would be that he progresses in his spiritual practice. Anyway, you can definitely get into a lot of trouble if you have a bad guru. Anyway, there you go. So you must have, this is number four, you must have what is called the completely degenerate mind, which denies the value of all virtuous actions, including generosity. You hold that these practices have no benefit or purpose. You even deny that virtuous activity exists. So in this way, it would be a person who feels that there's no benefit to supporting charities, that you only just lose your money, that you don't get any, there's no benefit that comes, that you don't get any mental culturing, and that your sense of happiness of helping people is just a weakness on your part, that you are attached to and dependent on that kind of happiness. You should be happy watching football games, something. So this is really the low point of wrong view. Obviously, this has the potential of destroying all positive efforts. So it's a completely degenerate mind. So the fifth aspect is present when the mind is overcome by this kind of wrong view. It's convinced and confident without shame and uninterested in avoiding such faults. When you possess these five elements of wrong view, it is perfect, complete, and fully developed. If any of these five are missing, then the karma is not complete. Just have a little moment here. Anybody have any questions, comments, anything? Okay. In the interviews, sometimes people come in and are expressing a kind of feeling of being ill at ease with, like, the remaining sheets in your folder have to do with the Buddha talking to somebody in a village and pointing out, like, the Todea comes and says, oh, I see people of all different fortunes and characters. Why is it like that? And the Buddha says, well, you know, according to people's karma, they're born in such and such a way, with such and such an appearance, or such and such resources, social status, so on like this. That's according to their karma. So then, of course, we feel like, oh, this has got to get explained more. because it seems like it could, you could easily twist this around, and this could be blaming the victims, because we had this discussion, this point that came up, that the people who were working in the meat industry, you know, the ones who were in a oppressed situation, the migrant farm workers, they're very marginalized, they're like illegal immigrants, they have no rights, they're very exploited, and then furthermore, then forced by extremely unfortunate circumstances, forced into like slaughterhouse jobs. They themselves don't wish that, but they have very few options. So then a person may ask, is that their karma? So from this worldview, yeah, that's the very serious ripening of unwholesome karma. And you know that because that's what's happening. When you see that, that's coming from somewhere. This is not like God didn't make that happen. It doesn't come without any cause. Because if you believed that things happen without cause, that it would have to be something that pervaded every aspect of existence. You couldn't just have one area of existence where there was nothing caused. So in that case, if you really believed that things were not caused, then you wouldn't put so much effort in going to school and getting your education, right? Because you would think going to school, it's not a cause that leads to anything, right? So we don't believe that. Anyway, I'm just scoping this around. So from this worldview to have that unfortunate situation of low status, being victimized, on like that, karmic ripening. Is that the same as saying that those people deserve that? It's not the same. It isn't a feeling that their humanity, like what shall I say? What the sense is that every human being has the potential, you know, for liberation. That there is a very precious intelligence and moral sensitivity in a human being that makes a human being a very special birth. And so when you look at a human being, you're connecting with that by way of compassion. You see that potential is a very precious one. So for a person who's holding this view of karma, you meet people who are in very distressed circumstances. This is the time for compassion. This is not the time to think everything is as it should be. No. It's terrible to experience the ripening of unwholesome karma. It is truly frightful and unbearable. And if you're a person who is a Dharma practitioner, you would not be satisfied to let it be like that. Beings can be uplifted. If somebody cares, and if you can get a handle on the causes to help them with their situation, that is certainly something to engage in. So I'm just ranting and raving to dispel the sense of fear, of complacency. And well, anyway, you see somebody who has, it's very deep in the human psyche. It's not, the Buddha isn't the one who said there, but for fortune. We have this already from way before you ever met Buddhism. You see somebody who has got a very unfortunate happening, then everybody feels like fear and compassion. There, but for fortune, go you or I. Right? So this is the natural response, is one of compassion.
Could I add a couple of just a little
please?
Masala point to that. there's quite a few things to say about that. One is to understand that, you know, having all in the Buddhist worldview, all of us having had many zillions of lifetimes, we all have karmas, negative karmas, heavy karmas just waiting for the conditions. So one of the first responses is to feel, oh, I have exactly the same karmas that have not yet ripened but for conditions. Yeah? And so I better practice to purify my own anger, attachment, and ignorance, because all of my karmas are due to ripen at any moment of confluence of conditions. So that's one thing. The second is that, you know, like for the Tibetans, it's very interesting, and when they first came out of Tibet, you know, their psychologists went and did studies about their, like their post-traumatic stress that they experienced there, because it was horrific when they came out of Tibet. Their country and culture was destroyed. 100,000 of them were killed. They watched their families and their monks and their nuns being killed and horrific things happening. And yet they were able to come out of Tibet with pretty good shape in terms of their mental health, pretty functional, and to just move right along in their practice of compassion, completely willing to say, this is our karma. And you'll hear His Holiness say, you know, you guys, you're creating the same kind of karma again here that happened with their, you know, sectarianism and infighting that created the situation in Tibet that caused you so harm. So my point is here that there's a lot of psychological health in taking control of the causes yourself, because what's the alternative? The alternative is that they done did it to us, and then you're just a victim, and you don't have the empowerment to make it different. So way better not to be a victim, because karma is empowering. It means you have control of your causes for the future. Yeah. Being a victim, of course, is total, you're at the mercy of external conditions, which are in charge of your happiness and suffering. Who wants your happiness and suffering to be under the control of, you know, just other people and conditions? So from your own point of view, it from your personal development point of view, it is better to see that it's your karma and now it's finished. You know, it's burned up. That karma is done. Now the question is, how do you relate to that circumstance? Because now you're going to create new karma for the future. Do you cultivate hatred, bitterness, and a sense of victimization? Or do you cultivate more healthy responses to that to take control of your results in the future? Nobody would think that having the experience of hatred and victimization is happiness. So in terms of the experience of the person, it is a hard, the really suffering part of the experience actually is the hatred and the sense of being a victimization. That's what makes one suffer when one is a victim. Yeah, it's not there's the pain of the conditions, but your ability to transform those conditions and pain are dependent on your sense of empowerment. So that's one thing. Another thing is, like in terms of karma, you know, if you looked around at the workers in the meatpacking plant and your participation in that in terms of buying meat, you're not saying, oh, those poor people, you know, they caused the conditions that are ripening in this way. You're saying, uh-oh, I am myself now creating the causes for negative karma by my participation, rejoicing, my passive acceptance. So from one's perspective, from the outside looking at, one's really concerned about what kind of karma oneself is creating. So there's no question of like accepting the status quo and the exploitation of peoples. Because then you're creating karma yourself, so you want to create karmas that are not participating in that and even correcting that. So you see, it's healthy from the point of view of the society that you feel like it's a very important karmically to fix these problems. And it's healthy from the point of view of the person that suffers, because they don't then experience, they feel more empowered, they don't in the present, and they don't suffer hatred and bitterness and feeling of victimization. And then they're empowered to actually, you know, take the controls of change into their own hands and change the circumstance. Yeah. So one has to deal with this problem of injustice in some way. And as Venerable said, the idea that it just happens for no reason, then it's chaotic. Then how could you change your society? How could you improve things?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, so just a little highlight that if a person finds meaning in their suffering, then it becomes bearable. You've got a way to organize yourself inwardly and to respond. So I leave this with you for your reflection. Thank you, and we'll make a dedication. This precious human life, so hard to gain and so easily lost, it is at the same time the condition for the arising of many unfortunate, unwholesome karmas. We generate compassion and a deep urge for realizing the truth of the way things are, for liberation, that we may be able to empty the suffering realms of beings and establish them in ethics and virtue and in practice and realization. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.